What is it with the beards? We have this program in Minnesota. We call it Inward Bound. We go fishing. Take 10 guys. We go up to the boundary water. Any fishermen here? Yes? Anyway, we go up to the boundary water area. Very, very nice place. It's pristine. It's protected. And we canoe out to a camping site. And we spend 4 days, 4.5 days. We're at the outfitters, which is at the dock. People are going out on their trips, and some people are coming in from their canoe trips. Some people go out for a day, some people go out for 4 days, some people go out for longer. So as we're standing there loading our canoes, a canoe comes in with two guys, and they look really, they look like they've been through the ringer. They haven't washed, they haven't. And somebody says to them, "How long were you out?" They said, "About a month." For a month, they're living on the fish they caught and the berries. So they looked a little grungy. Anyway, these guys turn around and they see me. And they said, "How long have you been out?" So I said, "I don't know. What year is it?" What's with the beards? This guy had a very long beard. A guy. Somebody came over to him and said, "I have one question for you. I'm just wondering. When you sleep, do you sleep with your beard above the blanket or under the blanket?" After that, he couldn't sleep for weeks. He tried it above, but it didn't work. Nothing worked. The beards are both traditional and modern. It's traditional for some reasons. It's modern for other reasons. But what is the true significance? Men have beards, women don't. You've heard about this? What is that? The Torah says, tradition teaches us, the hair, the facial hair, actually grows from the head towards the heart. Men need to have some connection between their cerebral self and their emotional self. So the beard is actually like a flow of energy that connects the mind and heart, so that what we understand also becomes a feeling, it also becomes our identity. Otherwise, we could remain so cerebral that it never really affects us. So the beard is actually a flow of concept to experience, making the ideas real to the heart. For most of history, on and off, people had beards. It's not limited to any one group. Could be that there was a time when beards were popular because they hadn't yet invented razors. But for whatever reason, men were always comfortable with beards. Other times, it became more common, more popular, to not have a beard. But the need for mental energy to flow to the heart is a universal constant. The theme tonight, uniting the beards, the chassid and the hipster, those who are comfortable being called chassid, and those who are comfortable being called hipsters, we'll just use those terms. I'm not sure exactly who I'm describing here. The unity, which has become necessary because life has thrown us together. The unity should begin in the mind and then flow to the heart. If it's not registered in the brain, if it doesn't make sense, if it's not compelling intellectually, then the heart is not going to get excited. And if the heart doesn't get excited, then what goes on up here becomes irrelevant. On the other hand, the heart has its own agenda, and if we don't feed it, if we don't guide the turbulent emotions of the heart, you never know where it's going to lead, and it can get ugly. So the unity has to be solidly based. So as a philosophical introduction, there is love and there is unity. They're not the same thing. And the amazing thing is, or the surprising thing is, love does not bring unity. Unity invites love. Because unity means, basically, we need each other. We are united, not through love. We are united through a common need. When people have a common need, they usually grow to love each other. Like soldiers thrown together in a battle, they come away very attached, very fond of each other because they needed each other really, seriously. So if there's going to be unity between any two groups, it would have to be based on a need. We need each other. I gotta tell this little story. A mother back in St. Paul calls me up. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. She says, "You're a rabbi. I need a favor. My son tried to commit suicide. He's 14. They're holding him in the state hospital, in the psych ward, for observation for 48 hours. No one is allowed to visit. The place is like a prison because you have some seriously dangerous people up there. I've been there before, and it is not a pleasant experience. They have double barred window doors. One locks before the other opens. The windows are barred. The nurses carry clubs and handcuffs. It's a pretty nasty place. And yeah, there's some maniacs, they're howling, threatening. The thought of a 14-year-old kid being up there with these psychopaths, I agreed to visit. Only clergy can visit. So I go up there, and it's as nasty as I remember it. And I walk into this boy's room. He's lying there on his bed, reading a comic book, like he's in summer camp. He's completely relaxed. He's comfortable. I tried to make some conversation. He's not interested. He just shrugs me off. I said, "Your mother asked me to come visit you." "Eh. Oh, she's worried about you, so what should I tell her?" I said, "Is everything fine here? You have anything?" Nothing worked. Finally, he says to me, "Why don't you go home? The chaplain has already been here." The hospital chaplain. I said, "Really? What did he say?" This kid says, "Something stupid." I said, "Well, now I'm really curious. What did he say?" "He said I shouldn't kill myself because God loves me." So I said, "That's stupid?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "I agree. You're absolutely right. I can't imagine God loves you. You're an obnoxious brat. What's to love?" He says, "Yeah. Well, at least I got his attention, huh?" I said, look, God created you. Obviously, you're a necessary part of his creation. Without you, there'd be a piece missing in his puzzle. So yeah, he's stuck with you. I can't imagine he likes you. So he says, well, what if I don't want to do what he created me for? I said, well, that's called freedom of choice. You have freedom of choice. He needs you for a certain purpose. If you volunteer to do it, fine. If you don't, that's freedom of choice. But at least now you're saying something. Taking a position. I like, I don't like. He didn't go much further than that. And I left. And on the way home, I realized that this boy is really onto something. He comes from a rather stable, nice family. It's not like he has terrible problems, that he's got the most miserable, unhappy life. So why did he try to kill himself? And now, he's lying there reading a comic book like everything's fine. He tried to kill himself because he was announcing to the world, I'm not necessary. I'm alive, but I don't have to be. I'm not necessary. So I've been alive for a couple of years. I tried it out. School is a little boring. I'll kill myself. What's the difference? I'm not necessary. Now, the chaplain comes along and says, no, don't kill yourself. God loves you. In his mind, God loves me? Well, there's something wrong with him. Because what? I'm not even necessary. How does love make sense when you apply it to something that isn't even necessary? This is, I think, a very important observation. Imagine parents say to their child, we never needed you. We don't need you. But you're cute, so we're going to keep you. We love you. Nobody wants to hear that. I mean, that may be good for a gerbil. You don't need the gerbil, but they're cute. A human being can't function like that. The first thing I need to know is that I'm needed. I'm necessary. My existence is justified. Now, if somebody loves me, that'll make it fun. But even if they don't love me, I'm necessary. I'm needed. In the olden days, people were needed. In fact, people had children because they needed the children to help plow the fields or whatever, or pick the cotton or whatever it was. Everybody was necessary. They came along and said, you're not only necessary, I love you. That was beautiful. It was great. That's like the icing on the cake. But the cake is the need, not the love. If we're going to be united, love can't do it. Because if I don't need you, then no matter how much I love you, we're not united, we're just enjoying. When the enjoyment goes, the relationship goes. Consider a marriage. If you need love from your husband, or you want love from your wife, it's going to tear the relationship apart. Because if you're after love, then you're not really after me. So you don't want me, you want love. But if it's me you want to be united with me, then my love becomes significant because it's my love. A husband does not need love from his wife. He needs his wife's love. That's very different. They're not the same at all. You don't need love from your children. That's so immature. And besides, if you need love, go back to your mother. That's where love comes from. Not from children. What you do need is your children's love. Why? Because your children are necessary to you. And then everything about them becomes lovable, desirable, and important. If there's going to be unity, we have to start with need, not with love. Love is the icing. It's not the relationship. We need each other. Partly because the world is a universe, and if we don't get together, if we don't work together, if we're not united, the world will never be what God intended it to be or what we would love to see it become. There are no unnecessary parts in the universe. There certainly are no unnecessary people. So either we get together and unite, or we tear ourselves apart. On what grounds do we unite? How do we need each other? Let's talk first from a Hasidic perspective. We are taught for the last 3,000 years that God created the world with a vision. A world that is a home, a pleasant, comfortable place for God Himself. Or in simple words, a God-like planet. In order for that to happen, the planet has to invite God. He can't impose Himself. Because that's not a relationship. If we are here to do and to serve God's purpose, then I cannot be content. I can't be satisfied with the fact that I'm doing my share. If I'm doing my share and you're not doing yours, then God is not getting what it needs and the world is not becoming what He envisioned. So what am I happy about? That I'm off the hook. That's not good enough. I'm not here to get off the hook. I'm here to help complete the job. And if I can't do it myself, then I need you. I cannot satisfy my existence unless we're both doing what it takes to make the world God. Now, there's been a lot of confusion. There's been a lot of heartache and disappointment in the transmission of these values and these teachings because of wars, dislocations. We've not had a very stable existence, and so it gets interrupted, it gets garbled, and it's very likely that the message becomes somewhat polluted by artificial influences from temporary philosophies, from other philosophies that don't fit. And all of a sudden, we have a philosophy that nobody can really get excited about. For example, you're taught that God is the judge. God is the ruler of the world, and you better behave yourself. That's the image. Now you read the Shema, and it says you should love God with all your heart. Excuse me. He's not lovable. I'll try, but it's not going to happen. I can't love Him. He's not lovable. There's nothing lovable about Him. So I get frustrated. At first I blame myself. I tell myself I'm not a good Jew. I tell myself I'm not a holy or godly person. Well, that's not comfortable. So eventually I tell myself there's something wrong with the whole system, there's something wrong with the philosophy. 4,000 years of wisdom goes down the drain. The Baal Shem Tov came along and noticed that this was happening. So he basically reshaped our thinking of God. He said, I want to tell you something that is absolutely essential to life. All life. God needs you more than you need him. Does that make any sense? If you think about it, it makes perfect sense. God created us. Our needs are temporary. In fact, our needs are artificial. Like, I need to eat. I don't need to eat. I need to diet. I need to not eat. I can't. So where did this need come from? It's not mine. And how long will it last? You know, you get a little older, your appetite starts to wane. So it's not a real need. But if God is eternal and he needs, then he needs forever. It's a real need. So he needs us more than we need him. So when he gives us a commandment, he's not doing us a favor. He's asking us for a favor. He's saying, help me with my need. I created the world with a purpose, and it's taking a long time. Help me out here. Well, all of a sudden, God is lovable. But why? Because we became needed. If we don't understand that God needs us, then we're missing the whole point, and we've got nothing to offer to the world. What Chassidus has to offer today to every human being in the world, the good things you do are more important to God than to you. Appreciate the significance of what you're doing. And that's called serve God. Do for him. So the message of Chassidus is, don't have this plastic God who does nothing but get angry. Have a living God. A God who came looking for us. A God who asks us to help him. Now we've got a basis for unity that makes love possible. If God doesn't need me, I cannot love him, and he can't love me. I think that's a pretty sound and essential ingredient in the joy of life, the enthusiasm for life. That's the Jewish message. It's a powerful, amazing, beautiful one. But we've been sitting on it. We've been talking to ourselves about it, thinking that nobody else is interested. Well, we can't keep doing that anymore. We need some fresh air. I'll tell you, most of what I've learned about Judaism, I didn't learn in yeshiva. I learned it when I came in contact with people who did not believe what I believe, who were never taught what I was taught, who were not interested in what I was interested in, and the questions and the discussions and the conversations. It is so enlightening. I realized what I had and appreciated it much more than before. We need that. We need to become a little more cosmopolitan. We need to take our message out of the confines and air it to the world. It'll do us a great service, and of course, it'll make a lot of people appreciate their place in God's creation. So we need each other. We need to learn from people who think global, who are concerned for the whole world, who have overcome barriers between races, between cultures, between religions. That's an amazing accomplishment. Now we have to give this openness, this universality, this cosmopolitan capacity, we need to give it some real content. Now that we're talking, now that we're crossing borders, what is it we have in common besides good intentions? Because they're never good enough. So we have to go back to the tradition, to something that has been true forever, something that has worked under all circumstances, when life was good, when life was terrible. What is it that is universally and eternally true? There was a time we didn't care. We didn't think there was a universal truth. So we experimented. The 60s and the 70s. Experiment. Try. Who knows? Nobody knows for sure. Let's find out. That's frustrating. And I think most of us don't want that anymore. Somebody comes up with a new philosophy of life. Don't give me a new philosophy. Try it out for 1,000 years and come back and tell me. But I don't want a newfangled idea. I want something that feels real, true, sound, and works, not just for today, not just for me, for everybody. The energy experience I had, I was in England. The BBC has a little program once a week where they invite somebody to give a 5-minute, or maybe even 3-minute, a 3-minute talk. A concept, an idea. I was invited to go do that. I go up to the studio, and there's this guy there, technician. You know, he's pulling in the plugs, and he's making all the connections, doing all these things. And he's kind of talking to himself. And he says, another Luke who thinks he can say something to 800 million people. Because the BBC goes out in all sorts of languages, it reaches 800 million people. And he's been doing this for a while, and he's just laughing at people. You come in here, and you make a little talk, and you think it's relevant to 800 million people? He has never. So that got me a little nervous. The Rebbe had just that week made a suggestion. He said, every school, every organization, every business, when they pay their workers, when they give them their salary, they should add $1. And suggest that that $1 be given to the needy. Because when you get your salary, you get what you need, you should think of someone else. So every school, every payroll, every organization, add $1 so that it's not just the two of you, but you're thoughtful of a third person who might need. That's what I said. I repeated the Rebbe's. And this technician says, I think you did it. Is this not relevant to 800 million people? Particularly those who are going to get the dollar? There are universal truths. They're so much more interesting than newfangled ideas. They're so much more satisfying. Where are they being held? Where are they being kept? Why are people who are profoundly wise, who have a great tradition, why do they hoard? Why do they hide their wisdom? Who are they saving it for? The answer is we just got comfortable being parochial. The world got comfortable living in ghettos or giant walls or fortified cities, and there was no thought of reaching across those borders to share what you have, unless it was to conquer others and force what you have on them, and that's not always welcome. So we need to do something special. We have the opportunity, because borders don't scare us anymore. Differences don't scare us anymore. We're beyond that. But when you get beyond that, you gotta have something to say. Let's all get together. Let's all be one happy family. And what? If you can't finish that sentence, the noble objective kind of falls apart. So, we need each other. We need each other because the world does not get fixed piecemeal. We're either doing it all or it's not happening. We all know, tikkun olam, we are all here to fix the world. We are here to serve. Who are we serving? The creator of the world, who has a vested interest in it. What do we know about God? What do we know about creation? Where are we going to find out? There is so much wisdom. There is so much knowledge. It's so rich. It's magnificent. Why aren't we sharing it? Why don't we have the confidence, self-confidence, to believe that what I have and what inspires me will also inspire you? So getting together, opening up the conversation, hearing the thinking and the awareness, the experiences that each of us has had, only enriches the tradition. It doesn't weaken it, unless it was weak to begin with. And on the other hand, all the open-minded and cosmopolitan search for a perfect world or a better world without some substantial truth, it's going to turn out frustrating. So I think it's a great blessing. God has given us a great gift in the fact that we are thrown together in a community and have to talk to each other. It can only bring benefit to everybody. So, I gotta tell you, I have a program. A woman's program for Jewish women who never had a Jewish education and want to do a little crash course on Judaism. It's been going on since 1970. It's a very exciting program. It's about a two-week program. Years ago, there was a woman sitting in the program, and she had this funny look, like she wasn't really there. So I finally called on her, and I said, "You want to ask something? I mean, what's?" She said, "No, I don't want to ruin anything." "You want to ruin anything?" She says, "Yeah, all the people here, they have their belief and they have their faith. I don't want to ruin everything." I said, "You have a question that's going to ruin everybody's faith? I'm really curious now." She says, No, I think better not." I said, "No, you got to tell me. What is this question that is going to ruin everything?" She says, "All right, you asked for it." Her question was, "Who created God?" I said, "That is such a good question. We asked it 4,000 years ago. Do you really think the sages have been studying God and Revelation and Bible and Torah for 4,000 years and they didn't ask that question? What kind of sages do you think we had?" If we are afraid, if we are timid, it's not because the tradition is lacking anything. It's because we are not open-minded, cosmopolitan, universal enough to apply what we're thinking to others. When we do, it's beautiful. It's magnificent. How can the message that God needs you, even if he doesn't love you, how can that not be inspiring? How can that not be helpful? How can that not be the cure for existential angst? On the other hand, if we just sit here thinking about it in Jewish neighborhoods, is this how the world is going to get fixed? not going to happen. So we need this combination of worldliness and purpose for the world. Come on. That's great. We need to be worldly to apply the message of the purpose of the world. But if you have the purpose of the world, but no world to talk to, it gets really stale. We start to get bored with each other. Infighting, competition, it's nasty. So, let's open it up. Here's a place where if you have any Jewish feelings, you know, some one day you're walking along and all of a sudden you're kind of feeling Jewish, come here. Doesn't matter what your background is, doesn't matter what your schooling is, doesn't matter what your observance is, doesn't matter what your belief is. Come here. Because here we recognize your necessity, how necessary you are. I got to end up with this story and then we can go to questions. There are these two Russian guys, peasants, sitting on a stoop in Russia. They're both a little tipsy. One of them is crying. The other one says to him, "Why are you crying?" He says, "Because I'm all alone in the world. I haven't got a friend." So the other one says, "What do you mean? I'm your friend. You have me. I'm your friend." So the guy who was crying says, "How can you call yourself my friend when you don't know why I'm crying?" That's profound. I'm your friend. You can tell me why you're crying. You know, if you were my friend, you would know why I'm crying. That's a very... I mean, it's consistent with what we're saying. Look, I love you. I care for you. When I see you crying, it bothers me. Tell me, why are you crying? Yeah, you love me. But if you needed me, if we were united, you would know why I'm crying. You're my friend, right? How could you not know? So let's get together. If we're going to overcome borders, let's overcome it completely. Not to the point where we can tolerate each other, not to the point where we can talk to each other, not to the point where we can like each other. Let's get together to the point where we cannot be without each other. We are not complete without each other. Because a fragmented world isn't good for anybody in the world. Does this make sense? Anybody write a question yet? Or
well, I didn't write it down. Did I ask it right?
Who's the moderator? Where'd he go? Man takes a job and disappears. Three questions. We'll start from the bottom. Can you be a chassid and not have a beard? Women are chassidim. Can you be a Jew and not believe in God? Yeah. If you're Jewish, you're Jewish. You can always change your belief. And even if you don't, you're a Jew. If you're a chassid, you were raised with Hasidic philosophy, and you think like a chassid, then you're a chassid. You don't have a beard, you're not the best chassid. But there's no contest. Number two. Why do some Orthodox shave their faces? Because they're not Hasidim? I don't know. You have to ask them. Real question here. What will Hasidic life look like 100 years forward? Will there be any changes? We like to think that there will be no changes because no change is necessary. We are perfect. We do everything right, and there'll never be a time or a need for change. I'm only half joking. What we have, what we are taught, the truth of Judaism does not need to change because it is universal and eternal and therefore should go on forever. Should we change? Every day. If you don't change day by day, you're not fully alive. But changing me doesn't mean changing God. God is stable, God is permanent, God is eternal. I have to change. Every day, I have to renew my thinking, my beliefs, my commitments. I have to check them out and see how sincere, how real, how deep, how far. I have to grow every day. And if you grow every day, then things will change. The only thing that doesn't change is God. And that's the great combination. It's a combination of an unchanging truth practiced by fickle, changing people in constant motion. That's a great combination. So if God changes, we'll be in trouble. If we don't change, we're in trouble. Any other questions? Yeah, I have a few questions too. If nobody asks, I'll just put in mine. If we are not afraid of borders, please help me understand the walls that Israel builds around itself. Obviously, I was being optimistic. We're not afraid of borders. And yet, you know, there's still a need for some kind of self-defense or protection. So we're not completely free of borders. But I was talking more of cultural borders, not military borders. I think countries should have secure borders, but that's just technical. That's military or whatever, not personal. So yeah, the wall in Israel, that's military. I'm talking about people to people. We've overcome. Not completely, but we've made great strides. Yeah. What is the difference between God and nature, and who created God? We never did get around to the answer on that one. I think one answer to both questions. Nature is a structure of laws and facts that have recognizable limits. To understand nature, you have to define its limits. You want to understand the universe? First thing you have to do is determine the size, shape. You can't figure out the size, then this subject is too big for you. So science, study of nature, is defining the limits where something begins and something ends. Anything that has a beginning and an end implies and suggests that there's a stronger power that gives it that limit. Because if, let's say, an atom was an independent being, why would it be so tiny? Why would it restrict itself like that? Why would it limit its talents? Can't sing, can't dance. What happened? So anytime we look at nature, we immediately notice that somebody, something, restricted you. Even the sun, as big as it is, can only shine on one half of the earth at a time. And it also can't sing or dance, that we know of. Who did this to the sun? That's how we came to the conclusion that there must be a God. So what do we mean by God? A being that has no limits, and therefore nobody had to create him, because there's no evidence that there's a stronger force imposed on God. So God means an endless being, all capable, with no restriction and no limits, because there's nothing bigger or stronger. Nature, on the other hand, actually proclaims its limits and therefore suggests a creator. So who created God? There's no evidence that he was created. He doesn't look like a creation. So the real question should be this: how do we know that anything was created? Maybe trees were always there, the sun was always there, stones were always... How do you know it was created? Because we found the limit. Things have a lifespan, a half-life. So we know there are more powerful forces. When we get to God, there's nothing more powerful, so who says he was created? He doesn't have signs of being created. On the other hand, if God is so perfect and so infinite, why would he create a tiny little world with all its limits? How could God, all-powerful, almighty, infinite, and perfect, how can he take an interest in people who can't live past 100 years and can't grow past 6'9"? Tiny creatures. How could he possibly be interested? What could nature offer him? Here's the correct understanding of God. And those who think they're God should think this way. God is infinite not because he's big. God is infinite because he has no limit, which means nothing is too big and nothing is too small. Only a totally infinite God can take a real, gutsy interest in tiny things, because he's without limit. So when a person says, "No, I'm not even interested in what sandwich you eat, how could God be interested?" Well, I'm not interested because I have only so much time and energy and I can't be bothered. God has plenty of time, plenty of energy, and he can be bothered. So he is. I think that's a more lovable God. The hoarding of good ideas and fragmentation of people dates to our getting the Torah and not sharing it with the angels, much less other people. Only Chabad reaches out to the non-Orthodox. How will Chassids change to reach out to the rest of society? Well, I'll tell you the rest of the story. We try to reach out to the angels. It's impossible to talk to them. Have you ever talked to an angel? They are so holy that you mention God and they flame up. You can't talk to them. They don't have enough skepticism to even think about God. They just burn up by the very mention. And that's why God can't talk to them. It's not that we kept the Torah from the angels. God kept the Torah from the angels. Because they're too excitable. You can't talk to them. When God comes to us, we can talk. You know, like the Noah routine, Bill Cosby's Noah routine. This is God. Really? Am I on candid camera? So we don't get so frazzled. We deal with God, and that's what he wants. Chabad did pioneer the outreach, open borders, no exceptions, Jews are Jews, so on and so forth. But it has caught on. It has become pretty much universal. I was in Israel not long ago. There is no Jewish organization that isn't proud of the fact that they reach out. How well they reach out, we can quibble about that. But nobody believes in being insular anymore. And that's very good. That's a very good development. We need to perfect this science and art, but we're working at it. And it's very, very satisfying. Very, very good. Hasidism started approximately 300 years ago in Eastern Europe. Has the philosophy changed with the migration to the U.S.? In fact, the previous Rebbe, who basically was fighting Stalin in Europe, in Russia, was forced to leave. His hands were tied. He couldn't function anymore because they were after him constantly. So he decided to move to a place where he can conduct his activities freely, even in the Soviet Union. And he chose the United States. There were larger Jewish communities in other places. He chose the United States. And he once explained, he came to the United States particularly because Americans are cosmopolitan. Because Americans think universal. And we need to learn that. If we have a universal message, then we've got to think global. So that talent, that openness, that confidence that Americans have appealed to the devil. Secondly, there was something very simple about Americans. Facts are facts. We're not so complex as Europeans used to be. I don't know what's going on now, but you know, all of their old money and their old vendettas and their family feuds. The United States was more innocent of that, particularly in the Wild West. People were earthy, simple. It was fresh ground to start Yiddishkeit flourishing again. And it worked. It worked. So yes, something did change from Europe. We're not hiding anymore. That's a big change. The Torah defines the world as the universe. But the word universe and the meaning of it is not mentioned. How does religion see life on other planets other than Earth, if it exists? There's no reason to assume that there isn't life on other planets. Why should we assume that? In fact, it would be quite exciting if there was life on other planets. What form of life? I don't know. It'll be exciting to find out. But we got to be careful to say we don't believe something is not an intelligent statement. A scientist asked the Rebbe, "Do we believe in life on other planets?" The Rebbe said, "You're a scientist. Go take a look. What are you sitting here and believing or not believing? Take a flight and go check it out. You're too lazy? Okay, don't turn it into a faith. I don't believe, I do believe." So why not assume that God created a magnificent universe? Who knows what's on those planets? Of course, don't assume to know that they're little green people, but other forms of life. The Torah defines the world as the universe, but the word universe and the meaning of it is not mentioned. Actually, the word universe is English and it doesn't have a Hebrew counterpart. The word for world in Hebrew, in Torah, is Olam. Kol Ha'olam Kulo, the world. And the word, the meaning of the word, is concealment. This world is a world that hides, it conceals. The waters, for example, hide all the life and all the activity that goes on underwater. It's concealed. The earth contains immense wealth, but it's concealed. The earth has a creator, but it doesn't admit to a creator. It seems to just sit there as if it always was. So when God created the world, He created a concealment which allows us to have freedom of choice. So that's why the universe is called Olam, to explain how it is that we gain this seeming independence so that we can either accept God or reject Him, listen to Him, not listen to Him. Where does this come from? He's the creator. Shouldn't we be compelled to be what He wants us to be? The answer is, this is an Olam. Here, God is concealed, leaving you free to either seek Him out or ignore Him. That's it? You want to just ask it out loud?
Well, I just wondered if you could go back to the hipster community, the city community idea. I'm wondering if you could just speak more about how you think the two communities could concretely, how they would concretely change with more interaction.
Thanks. Yeah, the question is, practically speaking, how do the two communities, the chassids and the hipsters, the bearded, how do we get together?
What do you see happening?
The first thing is, realistically speaking, we've got a big gulf. We're very different. We have so many differences. It's going to take a while. We're not going to meld. Hasidim are not going to become hipsters, and hipsters are not going to become Hasidim. We want unity, not uniformity. So it's going to take a while. But the beginning is a meeting of the minds. Talking, communicating, recognizing that we need each other. And then where does that go? Wherever it'll take you. It's like a Hasidic marriage. You don't really know each other. You get married, you're stuck with each other, now work it out. Because you have unity, you just don't have any communication skills. But once you have the unity, work it out. Let's get the unity. And how it'll develop and how it'll... Who knows? You know, like this kid in the hospital needed to know that he was necessary in God's plan. Is he lovable? We'll discuss that. We'll work on it. But like I'm saying, we try to create unity by having parties together, by loving each other. That has to be built on something solid. And that solid thing is, talk to me. Know my pain. Be necessary to each other. Then we can talk. And it's the one ingredient that we're still missing. With less insularity, how do you think the Williamsburg Hasidic community would change? How do you think the hipster community would change in reaction to more interaction with the Hasidic community? Again, I don't know the details. I do know both communities will be happier, enriched, and bigger beyond the borders. And that's good enough. That's reason enough. Whatever happens after that is icing on the cake. Our sages bring the Sambatyam as a proof for religion, why in fact, in today's knowledge, it's not found. While in fact, in today's knowledge, it's not found. It sounds like an old-time belief. The Sambatyam, we're told, is a river somewhere that is so stormy, it's such a raging river, that it throws up the stones from the bed of the river. And the 10 tribes who disappeared, they're on the other side of that river, and we can never get there. Where is this river? Is there such a river? Is it a metaphor? Is it actually true? Has anybody ever found that river? Some claim they did. The fact that we don't know today, that's not surprising. It's not surprising. Either the river calmed down and is no longer identifiable, or there are places we still haven't discovered. We have not explored the entire planet. There's a lot more exciting stuff to be discovered. Why everyone who is Jewish has to be frum? It can happen that some souls fulfill their frum mission and go back to secular. Can you be religious enough for one lifetime and then go back to being secular? Maybe I got to say this on another. No one should be religious. Religion does not help us overcome our borders and become one. Religion is not a Jewish concept. Religion are philosophies, beliefs, and movements that branched out of Torah. Torah was never a religion and should not be a religion. If you describe me as a religious Jew, I would be offended. It's an offensive word. Religious is too, it's too presumptuous, it's too self-righteous, it's too limiting. It's not what God wanted. I got to tell you this. There is no word in biblical Hebrew, in the Torah, there is no word for religion. It didn't exist until someone made a religion out of Judaism. We are not supposed to be religious. We're supposed to be Jewish. And why do you need to be more than that? So, what does frum mean? It's a bad word. If you put on tefillin every morning, are you religious? If you think that that makes you religious, you don't understand Judaism. A Jew puts on tefillin not because he's religious, but because he's Jewish. It's a Jewish thing, not a religious thing. If you saw an Indian with a feather in his hair, would you say, oh, Orthodox? No, he's an Indian. They wear feathers. A Jew puts on tefillin. Why? Jewish. Why do we turn it into a religion and then isolate ourselves and then get into arguments? Who's more religious, less religious? Cut it out. Cut it out. God did not speak to religious people at Mount Sinai. There wasn't a single Orthodox Jew there. They were the children of Israel. And God said, if you're the children of Israel, do this for me. So we did. Who turned it into a religion? I understand. We lived in Christian countries and Muslim countries. They called their belief a religion, and we got stuck with that title. So you imagine a Muslim says to a Jew, you believe in the Torah? Yes. So that's your religion? No. Well, if you believe in it, it's your religion. See, my religion says this. What does your religion say? And after a while, we couldn't fight it anymore. And all of a sudden, there were three religions. Don't do that. Don't go there. Let me end with one story. Everybody understand a little Yiddish? A few words? I'll translate. There was this little community in New Jersey years ago. They were all farmers, egg farmers. Eventually, the big corporations put them out of business. So they all went into construction. 30 families living outside of, I don't know, Tom's River. Anybody familiar? Anyway, it was farmland. They all went into construction. They all spoke Yiddish. They were from Poland. They all became wealthy. But they were so community-minded that the 30 families were like one big family. They had this rabbi there whose name was Rokeach. He came from a very famous, well-known rabbinic dynasty, Hasidic dynasty. But in the war, he lost a family, many children. He had a nervous breakdown, and he barely survived. When he came to America, he moved to that community, and these families adored him, felt terrible for him, so they appointed him their rabbi. He was shattered. He was a broken man. He was an alcoholic. But they loved him, and they felt so bad for him that they built him up. We would go to visit these families to invite them to put on tefillin, to send their kids to a Jewish school. Every Sunday we would go. And we had a number of families that we would visit every week. One guy, Chaim, was on our route as we got back to the highway, so he was the last stop every Sunday. Delightful guy, had the best bar in his basement, and we would stop there every week. Every week we asked him to put on tefillin, and every week he refused. Don't know why. Great conversation, great friendship, no tefillin. And we tried every argument. We said, you know, tefillin is a big mitzvah. Next week we said, tefillin is such an easy mitzvah. Put them on, say shema, take them off. We said, you know, your son is 11 years old. He's going to start bar mitzvah lessons soon. He should see you putting on tefillin. Do it for him. Nope. We got so desperate, we said to him, look, we come here every week. Do us a favor. He says, ask me for some other favor. He wouldn't. One Sunday we arrive and we go to visit this Rabbi Rokeach. He's all smiles. Unusual. So we asked him, what's so special today? He says, there was a bris, circumcision in one of the families, so we all got together. And it was Sunday morning, so those who are accustomed to putting on tefillin took out their tefillin and put them on. They took them off, put them on the table, somebody else put them on. He says a line was forming, people waiting to put on the tefillin. But this guy, Chaim, was standing off, uninterested. So he said in his heavy Polish, lispy Yiddish, for those who understand Yiddish, he says, "Binach fein fige ganyen, ani chabeim givokt, chayin, ale idith the kinder leiden tfillin, vut bithti am mamve." He said to them, "Chayin, the children of Israel are putting on tefillin. What are you, illegitimate? You're not one of us?" He rolled up his sleeve and he put on the tefillin. You see, we were talking to him about a religion and he said no. We told him it's a mitzvah. He said, I'm not into that. this rabbi said to him, Jews do this. Are you excluding yourself? Oh, don't mess with me. I'm as Jewish as you are. And he put on the tefillin. So the point of it is this. The word religion is not Jewish. Being religious is not Jewish. A Jew should do a mitzvah only because he's Jewish, not because he has a philosophy, a belief, a religion. Get rid of that. A guy's running down the street. And you stop him. You say, what's the matter? He says, my wife is not feeling well. I'm going to get the doctor. And you say, wow, you love your wife. He says, I didn't say anything about love. We're not getting along so good lately. Would you suggest, well, in that case, slow down, bus lifestyle. Let's have a cup of coffee, we'll talk, you'll get the doctor later. What would he say? He would say, you're out of your mind. My wife needs a doctor. And you say, but you don't love her. He would say, what's love got to do with it? So what? That's how we relate to God. If you put on tefillin and somebody comes to you, or you light Shabbos candles, and somebody comes to you and says, oh, you really love God. I didn't say anything about loving him. Well, then why are you doing this? He asked me to do it. He's my God. That's so beautiful. That is so Jewish. And some people call it hypocrisy. A Jew is sitting in shul or in synagogue on Yom Kippur, but he doesn't believe in God. He has no intentions of being religious. And when he gets home, he's going to eat. So you can say, oh, what a hypocrite. What is he coming to synagogue for? To show off how Jewish he is? You're missing the point. He comes to the synagogue because, come on, a Jew is supposed to be in a synagogue. It's Yom Kippur after all. Say, oh, so you do believe in God. I don't know. Leave me alone. I'm Jewish. That's not good enough. That's not reason enough to do Jewish things. Come on. Don't turn it into a religion. That's what we're trying to get away from. That's why we need a universal message from God, not a parochial one. Not one that sets religions against each other. We've had enough of that. So let's just be authentically Jewish. Why do you do Jewish things? Why do fish swim in the water? They love it? I'm not so sure. But they're fish. Let's go back to being Jewish. That will be our first common ground, because nobody is more Jewish than anybody else. It's a good starting place. So thank you for that question, because the word has got to go.